the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Today we're looking at moulding culture. And I thought, just to help us at the beginning, we'd watch a little video clip to think a little bit about what actually is culture. Now, that was a part of a series of HSBC adverts looking at differences in culture. So in England, we think it's polite to eat everything on your plate to show your host that you really enjoyed the meal. Or as I said, like in certain Southeast Asian cultures, it's actually to show how generous your host is, you have to leave some on your plate. So these are kind of, there are very funny misunderstandings that can happen, but then there are sometimes more serious ones that can happen as well. So how is culture formed? Well, culture, some people think culture is being interested in arts and literature and being cultured. But actually, this guy's a comic book guy from The Simpsons, and he's just as much a part of culture, part of American culture. So culture is a shared way of life. It's those things that are normal in our lives. What we think is normal, our values and our attitudes. It's a shared code of conduct, like clearing your plate or not, depending on where you're from. And it's learned and it's integrated. It includes our customs, our values, our beliefs, and it's formed by our institutions. And obviously here, our cream teas are very important in Devon, aren't they? Well, culture can give us a sense of unity, a sense of identity, and a sense of belonging. This is a culture of a company, and it's words that people think of about their company and what's important in that company. And sometimes our cultures are moulded, aren't they, by our families. We have a little family culture, things that we normally do in our family. Or we have a community culture, things that are right or we see as right in our community. We have a workplace culture. And sometimes it can change because of outside influences. So, for example, after World War II, Japanese culture adapted and had an incredibly hard work ethic as they tried to repair and restore their country. This week at work, I've been looking at the Romans and the impact they had on Britain, the incredible Roman road structure, all the good systems and building their cities. Unfortunately, we haven't taken on board the lovely underfloor heating that they invented many, many years ago, which I think we should definitely reintroduce to the UK. Now, schools and universities help to mould our culture, don't they? Our education system. But many of them were formed by churches. But more recently, secularism has become more popular within our society, and religion is squeezed out of education. At the beginning of World War I, every soldier was given a copy like this of a New Testament before they went into battle. There were 43 million of these produced. And this is actually just a copy of the Gospel of St. John. And this is a replica one, and it's got in it some stories from people who were in the war, in the trenches. And there's one at the back, which I found really interesting. This soldier wrote, "When your small testaments were distributed on the common at Southampton, I, among others, accepted one more in a derisory than a complimentary manner. I little dreamed that I should use it and find it great consolation in lonely hours. I have learned to realise the great personality of the Saviour. When at night I've been on duty alone with him by my side and the Germans but 30 yards away, I realised that I needed more than my own courage to stand the strain. When the shells of the enemy have burst periodically at my feet, I have marvelled at the fact of still being alive." Many soldiers' lives were changed and transformed by reading this because they were able to take it into battle with them. But would we be able to give Bibles now to our soldiers? Many schools have banned celebrating Christmas. Some towns have no Christmas lights or Christmas trees. There's been a huge change in our society, in our culture, in our country. Years ago, there were Christians in business. This is one of my favourite. This is George Cadbury, who founded Cadbury's Chocolate. Very important person. And he said We can do nothing of any value to God except in acts of genuine helpfulness done to our fellow men. He was a Christian, and he built houses for his workers that were far superior to any other working class homes at the time. He provided medical and dental treatment for them. He treated his workers with respect and with love, with God's love. But businesses have changed, haven't they? So many businesses now, on the whole, are trying to make as much money as possible and pay their workers as little as possible. So many people are on 0 hours contracts. Great for the employer, terrible for the employee. I've had many different jobs over the last 10 years, and it seems the same in every organization. Our culture has changed. Even the laws that passed in the last 20 or 30 years have been against our faith. Abortion laws, Sunday trading laws, marriage laws. What are we doing as a people to tackle that culture change? Why has there been a change? Are there less people in politics, less Christians in politics? There are less positive impact of our faith. We definitely have less influence. So how are we responding? Do we get sucked into the culture around us, or do we stand up to mould our culture? And how can we? And we're going to look at a passage this morning in Matthew's Gospel, which talks about how we can help to mould our culture. And it's in Matthew chapter 5, which is on page 917 on the green Bibles. There should be one in front of you. Page 917. So Matthew 5, verse 13. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. So you are the salt of the earth. Now, various commentators have ideas about what on earth this is talking about. What does it mean to be salt of the earth? Well, some people think it's whiteness. The whiteness of salt represents purity, and we are supposed to be pure in the world. And while that's true, I'm not sure that's exactly what this passage is saying. If you look, there's a picture there of what our salt looks like. It's white, it's purified. But the salt that first century Palestinians would have used is more like the salt on the right. So it's come straight from the Dead Sea. And it has a very different texture and consistency and colour. Some people think it's flavour, because salt brings flavour to your food, doesn't it? And they imply that we're supposed to bring flavour to the world. And maybe we are, that's a great thing. Some people think it's you've got to sting the world with rebuke and judgment, the way salt stings an open wound. Not a very cheery thought. I actually went to Israel quite a few years ago when I was a teenager with my mum and dad, and we went to see the Dead Sea, and we were all looking forward to trying to lie on it, because it's supposed to be, you know, that salty that you can actually lie on the top of the surface of the water. So anyway, the day before, we had been walking around Jerusalem. I don't know if anyone's been to Jerusalem, but there's masses to see. It's a fantastic place, and we walked for literally miles and miles. And I'm sorry, this is a shoe story. My mum had just bought me some very sensible Clark sandals, and the leather is very strong on them, and this was the first day I had worn them. So I got massive blisters, and it was really, really painful. So anyway, the next day I forgot all about it, went to the Dead Sea, got into the Dead Sea with the blisters on my feet. It was so painful. It was agony. It was the worst pain I thought you could possibly have. That was before I had children. So it was horrible. And I'm not sure that's exactly what the what Jesus is talking about here either, but it is part of salt. It does sting an open wound. And some people think, well, maybe it's creating a thirst. When you have too much salt, then you want to thirst for water. So maybe we need to help the world to know they need a thirst for Jesus. They need to know more and more about Jesus. Well, perhaps it's that too. But the primary use of salt for the disciples was to stop decay. They didn't have a fridge, so all the fish that they caught would spoil and it would rot unless they packed it into salt. Salt was incredibly valuable because of this in the ancient world. Many of the Roman soldiers actually received their wages in salt. So as Christians, we're supposed to help stop sin's power to decay. Decay our society, decay individuals, decay our world. But there's a stark warning in this passage, isn't there? But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can salt lose its saltiness? Well, again, we use very purified salt, but the salt of the time wasn't purified. It was collected from these deposits left by the Dead Sea and dried. But sometimes when it's exposed to elements, it would break apart and lose its flavor, and then it would be useless. Or it could become contaminated, and then it was even poisonous. You couldn't use it at all, so you'd throw it out onto the road. That's just like our faith, too. Sometimes we can lose our enthusiasm if we don't take care to keep our relationship with God alive. Someone once said to me, I used to be really excited about my faith when I was a student, but after 20 years, I've kind of lost my passion for Jesus. It's really sad, isn't it? And it happens to so many of us. How do we keep our faith alive? How do we keep our excitement in what Jesus has done for us alive? What drains our passion? Are we being molded by the world? Are we damaged by things that happen in churches or relationships with other Christians? Are we tired? Are we losing hope? Well, salt's also figurative in the Old Testament. A person could join in a salt covenant with somebody else and with God. And if they break it, just the same as this, they're only fit to be cast out. A covenant of salt was supposed to be a permanent relationship. I've got a little illustration over here. I'm quite a visual person, so forgive me if you're not a visual person. But if you are, just have a look over here. Right, so basically, in ancient times, a salt covenant, you would have your pouch with your salt in it. So pretend that's a little pouch. And if you wanted to make a covenant with someone else, you'd take a little bit of salt, like this, and you'd put it in their pouch. And then they would take a little bit of salt from their pouch, and they'd put it in yours. Okay, simple. Now, you could only break the covenant if you could take your salt out. And of course, you can't. You can't find which salt, bits of salt are yours and which are theirs. You can't take it out. So that was the whole point of a salt covenant, that it was supposed to be permanent. So many people use that in a marriage ceremony as well. They have that idea of a covenant that's forever. I wonder, have we made a salt covenant with God? Have we said, I want to be in relationship with you forever? If you haven't, then do chat to any of us who've been up the front at the end. We'd love to talk to you. Passage goes on, doesn't it? You are the light of the world. A city on a hill. Now, we love going to Italy, and there's some amazing towns and cities that are built on top of hills. This is one called Col Valdelsa, and you can see it for miles and miles around. There's another one called Volterra, and it's just beautiful. From miles and miles away, you can see this city at the top of the hill, and as you come towards it, you see it clearer and clearer. And the whole idea of this is that you can't miss it. It's there, it's obvious, it's visual. It's not hidden away. And I wonder if we sometimes feel like that. Sometimes we want to hide away. Yes, we're a Christian, but we don't want to say too much at work because maybe people will think we're strange, or maybe we'll get in an argument and we won't know how to solve it. I know a couple of weeks ago, I was at work, and I was feeling terrible. I'd had this horrible virus thing, and I dragged myself into work because it was a really important teaching day, and there was no one else to cover. So I went in, and I managed to do the session, and then I sat in the little kind of staff room area trying to hide away. And it was quite dark, and there was no one there, and I thought, I'll just shut my eyes and have a little sleep. And then one of the senior lecturers came in and said to me, "You're a religious person, aren't you?" And I was thinking, oh, no. Because I was too tired to cope with having a whole discussion. But I thought, how do you answer that? What do you say? So I said, well, actually, I'm not really a religious person, but I am a Christian. I have a faith in Jesus and a relationship with him. And it's really, really important to me. And I said, but today I feel terrible. So please, can you come back another day and ask me all about it? And I will tell you all about him. So there are times, aren't there, when we need to hide away. But there are other times when actually it's important to have a reason for our faith, to be able to say, yes, I believe in Jesus, and this is why. And this is the difference he makes in my life every day. So we're the light of the world. Light shining in darkness is unmistakable, isn't it? You can't miss it, just like that city on the hill. But it stands out, not for our sake. People will see the good deeds and not praise us. It's not an ego trip. People should see us and praise God, to see what God is doing in our lives. Now again, in first century Palestine, this is the kind of light that they were talking about. It's a clay lamp filled with oil and then burnt at the end through a wick. And the bowl that he's talking about, you wouldn't put it under a bowl, which is in verse 15. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. That bowl was a 2-gallon bowl that they would put meat or flour in. So it's a clear illustration. Nobody in their right minds would light a lamp and then put the huge bowl on top of it so you couldn't see it. It's just obvious, isn't it? And I love the way Jesus uses pictures that are so clear and so obvious. And obviously it loses a bit for us because we don't necessarily know what he's talking about. But that's the light. A light like that. And it would be a crazy waste of oil, wouldn't it, to light that lamp and then to leave it. Israel as a nation was supposed to be a light to the world. Isaiah reminded them, you were supposed to be a light to the world. But they had failed. And I wonder, do people see a light in us? Are we a light? And I think, just as we said, the challenge of losing that passion is, what are the choices that we are making? Are we making any choice which blurs the difference between us and the rest of the world? Because if we are, maybe it's a step in the wrong direction. Sometimes we do this because it's easier. We choose comfort and an easy life. Sometimes we do it because it's a conscious decision to disobey God. We choose sin because it's tempting. Are we actually different to the world around us? Can anybody see a tangible difference between us and our neighbours? So how can we resist being moulded by society? Well, Jesus is a fantastic example. At the beginning of his ministry, he went into the desert and he was tempted by the devil. And each time the devil tempted him, he came back with a Bible verse. It wasn't a good luck charm. It was a reminder to him about what was true and what was good and what was pure and what was noble. And that's what we can do too, if we know his word. I read a survey recently by Ofcom, which surveyed about 3,000 adults. And they said the average adult spends 8 hours and 41 minutes on media devices. And only 8 hours, 21 minutes actually sleeping. That almost 4 hours a day are spent watching TV. Now, there's nothing wrong with watching TV or movies or the internet. But how much time do we read the Bible? Maybe on Sunday, the short passage during the sermon. Maybe a couple of minutes every day if we're lucky. Where is our instruction coming from about what is normal? About what is right? About what is true? What messages are we hearing? It's really important when you look at a passage to look at the whole context of what it's in. this passage we're looking at is in the midst of the Sermon on the Mount. So the sermon that Jesus gave, whole talk. So do read it through later if you have time to, or make time to. Jesus calls on his followers to be different from the world around them. He proclaims an upside-down kingdom. Now, we're not saying biblical culture is the culture of the Middle East at the time, and we can reject it because it's a different culture to ours. God did speak to a specific nation at a specific time, but it wasn't one set culture. In fact, ancient Israelite culture was supposed to be different to the culture around them. They were supposed to show what God was like. They had the most incredibly fair and just system for a society ever. But they couldn't live it out. They wanted to be just like the world around them. They asked for a king. They didn't want to help the poor, etc., etc. And Jesus, too, challenged the culture of his day with God's values. He declared an upside-down kingdom. Just like last week's shocking story of the Good Samaritan, where the priest and the Levites, who thought they were right at the top of the society, the top of the pyramid in society, but yet the hero was a Samaritan who was way down at the bottom of society, below the tax collectors, below the prostitutes, below the real sinners. You had the Samaritan. That was what was so shocking for the listeners of that story. There's a book that Donald Crable wrote, which is called The Upside Down Kingdom. He wrote it 30 years ago, but it's been reprinted a couple of times. And he said, the kingdom of God points to an inverted, upside down way of life that challenges the prevailing social order. It challenged society and culture then, and he challenges society and culture now. Jesus begins his sermon saying, blessed are the poor, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the pure in heart, blessed are the merciful, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed are those who are persecuted. This was not what anybody expected to hear, and it was certainly not what their culture championed, and it's not what our culture champions either. And we need wisdom too, don't we? We need wisdom not to put ourselves in the way of temptation. In 1 Corinthians, Paul writes, everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. And later on in this same sermon, Jesus says, if your right hand causes you to sin, chop it off. It's a bit like, I don't know if you can see this, this is our ceiling in our lounge. We had a leak and some water coming in through a cracked roof tile up above it. And when the man came to fix it, he looked at it and he kind of felt around on the plasterboards. And he said, actually, we need to cut out two whole plasterboards, take them all off, put some new ones up, and then plaster it. And the hole was only a tiny. Unfortunately, he had finished before I got to take a photo. So there's a little yellow shape about where the hole was. It was a tiny little hole. I thought he could just stick something in there and plaster over it and it would be fine. But no. We had to have the two boards removed, he had to put new boards up and then plaster it. And sometimes it's a bit like that with our lives. Sometimes we think, oh, it's only a little thing, it doesn't really matter. But actually we need to look at everything behind it. We need to think, don't we? It's no good just covering up and pretending that everything is all right. Actually, sometimes we need drastic action. If you're an alcoholic, you wouldn't spend all day in a pub. There's nothing wrong with going into a pub, but if you're an alcoholic, it can be a toxic environment. There's nothing wrong with going to a gym, although I can always think of lots of reasons not to go. But if you've got a crush on your gym instructor, maybe it's not a good place for you. It can be toxic. There's nothing wrong with Facebook. Nothing wrong with looking up old friends. But if you're looking up an ex-boyfriend or girlfriend and your marriage is in trouble or distant, that can be toxic too. We need to think, don't we? We need to be honest with God and with ourselves. It's crazy, isn't it? God already knows what our weakness is. We can fool ourselves sometimes, we can fool other people, but we can't fool him. And actually, we all have these problems. None of us are any worse or any better than the other. And we can change habits to help ourselves. Maybe you need to give something up. Maybe you need to change gym. Maybe you need to change teams at work. Maybe you need to give something up that perhaps you do really enjoy, but that's unhelpful. Maybe you need to give up an unhelpful friendship if you're with a group of friends who are always gossiping or critical. Maybe you need to stop reading certain books or watching certain films. It may be permissible, but it may not be beneficial to you. We need to be honest. And it may be painful, but we will have long-term benefits and long-term blessing. And we've got life group support and spotlight groups that we can go to help us. I wonder how many people have been honest enough to attend their spotlight group on pornography, say. This is a chance to speak confidentially to other Christians without any judgment and to find help and possibly peace. Why not take it? We need to be honest. And the great thing about church is no one could judge. No single person can judge another, as we are all sinners. We really do all fall short of the glory of God. We don't have to stand up the front, thankfully, and tell the whole world what our issue is. You can if you want to, but I'm not going to. But you do need someone to talk to. And I do confess to my closest friends and to God and ask for prayer and for guidance to fight sin in my life. And it really helps. It helps to know that I'm not the only one. It helps to know I'm not alone. It helps to know I'm not a horrendous failure. I'm just human. But through God's power and strength, I can and we can overcome. One of my favourite verses is this one in Philippians 4. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. So how can we resist being moulded by culture? We can be salt, we can be light, we can be visible. We can use God's word to help us, to strengthen us, and to give us support. How can we mould culture just the same way? To be salt, to be light, to be visible. And how can we do it? We can do everything through him who gives us strength. In his book, Mark Green makes loads of suggestions about how we do that practically, like perhaps having coffee and cake at work once a week. Somebody at my work has already beaten me to that, but it is a lovely time where you can get to talk to your colleagues and chat and support each other. I remember hearing Professor John Bryant once talk about when he went to Sainsbury's, and he always used to talk to the man who was pushing the trolleys around. And he'd just have a little chat and then go and do his shopping. And then one day he was on Spotlight and he was interviewed about something. He was a professor at the university, something to do with biology, some kind of sciencey thing. But anyway, he went to Sainsbury's the next time, and he said hello to the trolley man. And the man said to him, "Aren't you that professor guy who was on TV?" And he went, "Yeah." And the trolley man said, "Well, why are you talking to me?" And I thought that was wonderful. That he, you know, it's the whole idea of love. Every single person's important, whether they're the cleaner or the vice chancellor of the university or the CEO of your company. We treat everyone with love and grace, as we were learning last week. So cultures are moulded by the dominant people, the dominant forces within them. We can help, with God's help, to mould our culture for his glory, our families, our workplaces, our nation. But we need to immerse ourselves in him, in his spirit, and his word to be able to do this. We need to acknowledge our weaknesses. Are we bringing God's light to the world? Are we helping to stop moral decay? Or are we losing our saltiness and hiding under a bowl? It starts with us. It starts where we are in our homes, our families, our workplaces. It starts with me and you as individuals. It's easy to point to others and show them what they need to do, but first we must look at ourselves and cry out to God for mercy. And we're going to celebrate communion together now, and it's a wonderful moment to remember this, to remember that we can bring God's love to the world because he first loved us. We can bring light to the world because God sent his Son to be the light of the world. We can help be salt in this world because God has worked in our lives first. We're going to have a moment of silence in a minute. And I'm going to pray. And during the silence, just let God speak to you. If you haven't yet made a covenant with him, asked him into your life, then think about doing that. If you have, ask him to shine his light in your life and show you where you need to change. So Lord, shine your light into the dark areas of our lives. Show us if we need to cut anything out or change our behavior, Lord, for your glory.